You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Play ball! It's 30 with Murdy with your host, Sweeney Murdy.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back. On this episode, a conversation with filmmaker Andrew Bergman. If you don't know his name, you certainly know his work, and there are some sports connections. Bergman was a part of the team of writers behind Blazing Saddles, alongside the legendary Mel Brooks and Richard Pryor. That film script came from Bergman's story idea and evolved from there into one of the top comedies on anyone's list. Some interesting stories in here about the writing process there. Bergman, a New York native and longtime Yankees fan, also wrote the screenplay for the Chevy Chase classic Fletch, easily one of the most quotable movies of the last 40 years. His other credits include Honeymoon in Vegas, It Could Happen to You, Striptease, Little Big League, The Freshman, and The In-Laws. The In-Laws starred the great Peter Falk, and it actually served as a jumping-off point for Bergman to write the script for a baseball movie called The Scout. Now, that film was made in 1994 and starred Brendan Fraser and Albert Brooks about a phenom discovered by a disgraced Yankee scout in some outpost of the Mexican League. Okay movie, not a classic. Some fun moments, including cameos by George Steinbrenner and John Sterling, also Bob Costas, Bobby Mercer, and Ozzie Smith. But it was originally conceived and scripted several years before that, and last summer I heard a story from Hollywood producer Mike Lobel how The Scout was originally written for John Belushi to star in, and that concept blew my mind. So I reached out to the screenwriter, Mr. Bergman, to talk about that crazy idea, he has other very funny and very quotable movies, and his lifelong love of Yankees baseball. My love for movies and sports, and movies about sports, collide here once again. Here is my conversation with writer, director, producer, Andrew Bergman. Andy, the first thing I want to ask you is there is a version of The Scout, which you wrote, that has John Belushi in mind as the star, Peter Falk in the Albert Brooks role as the scout. What kind of movie was this going to look like, and how close did it ever get to being made?
It didn't get close to that. That was the original conception. I mean, I owned this, the story by Roger Angelo. There's a great piece he wrote about this called The Scout. And I had just done The In-Laws, so I heard Peter Falk was in my mind all the time, and he seemed like the perfect guy to be a scout, because this guy was completely obtuse. All he knew, you know, was baseball. And he goes to Mexico and he finds a guy who turns out to be Abby Hoffman on the Run, an escaped Chicago 7 guy. And he's had plastic surgery done in a completely makeover. And he's had these shots from this Mexican doctor, only the second white man who had ever gotten these shots, the first being Babe Ruth. So he brings this guy back to the States. And he's basically, it's like he's brought King Kong back. He hits the ball like 900 miles. And then eventually the guy gets caught because he is an escaped political prisoner. And the scout is so obtuse, they say to things, I was in Chicago in 68. You remember Chicago in 68? And he said, yeah, the bullpen was no good. You know, that's like he saw the whole world through that prism. So he had no idea what he had, you know. So that was a great version, but we couldn't get it off the ground. And Belushi was sort of in, was sort of out. And then he died, which really eliminated him as a possibility. And then there was a version with Walter Matthau. And that fell apart for the reasons that things fall apart in movies. And then it got resuscitated with Albert Brooks for some reason and Michael Ritchie. But it was a very changed version.
So Belushi actually saw the version you wrote for him, though.
Oh, yeah. I had a meeting with him. He was shooting the Blues Brothers in Chicago. So when I went out and met with him and Aykroyd, and Belushi was a lovely guy, but he had the attention span of a fruit fly. I mean, you couldn't talk to him for more than 4 seconds. So it wasn't easy. You had to sort of pin him down there. The way we got him was the Warner Brothers, head of Warner Brothers was with us. And Belushi went, how many hours he could get on the plane? You know, how much use could he make of the Warner's plane? That was the way we got him in.
That's hilarious. Do you think that there's a lot of ifs, and I understand there are always a lot of dominoes to fall in the movie making process, but if he hadn't died in 1982, this movie got made in 1994. Do you think at some point this is something that you could have accomplished with him, or it just wasn't going to happen?
Oh, no. I mean, with him, dubious. I mean, he knew his brand, as they say now, you know, which was Jake Blues and sort of those guys he did, these sort of animals. This guy was a different kind of animal, you know?
Yeah.
But super big, because Peter could have done this in his sleep. He was like perfect.
Yeah. I think Albert Brooks is hilarious. What did you think of the version that finally got made?
I think Albert Brooks is a fantastic comic. I didn't think he was a scout. I don't think he can play stupid. I mean, obtuse. He can play a lot of things. Neurotic, as good as anybody who ever lived. He can play neurotic. But that kind of tunnel vision that like Peter had, and I think Matthau could have had, I don't think that's in his color scheme. But I love him. I think he's a hilarious guy. I mean, he's done some movies that were paralyzingly funny.
I know you are a longtime Yankee fan, so there are some people who make some wonderful cameos in this movie that I'm sure you had a kick being around.
We went to get permission to use Yankee Stadium because we were going to shoot in Yankee Stadium. Mm-hmm. So we go to sit in Steinbrenner's box. I'm with Peter Falk, who brings along Ben Gazzara and John Cassavetes, plus the head of Fox, Sherry Lansing, wonderful woman. And we get there, I can't remember the year, it's in the 80s, but Ed Figueroa is pitching. Okay. And Ed Figueroa gets his brains knocked in. And Steinbrenner says, we're sitting there, he says, he spit the bit on me for the last time, gets up and walks out of the box. And the next day, Figueroa is gone. They released him the next day. So that was the best baseball story I got out of this.
You got to witness George Steinbrenner up close and personal.
Being George.
Hey, you were involved in another baseball movie as executive producer. It also came out in 94. Little Big League. What did you, there are a lot of stars in this movie too. A lot of baseball stars in this movie. Ken Jr.'s in it. Randy Johnson's in it. And there's a host of other really recognizable players that made appearances in this. What'd you think of that experience?
I was executive producer. As Mel Brooks was around and doesn't do much anything. But it was a sweet movie. We originally wanted to do it in Kansas City. The problem was we had to get the Metrodome, and the Metrodome was not a beautiful place to shoot a movie, you know? Mm-hmm. It's a little dead. And Kansas City had this gorgeous ballpark, still does, the same place.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the prettiest ballparks in the majors. And none of those domes to me has any appeal as a baseball field whatsoever.
Yeah.
It was a nice experience. Certainly it was a pleasant experience.
You needed it for the weather purposes, right? Shooting in the winter.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
I had Timothy Busfield on this probably a couple of years ago. And he told me some wonderful stories about this. One of them was that, you know, he tried to get like Randy Johnson was supposed to lay one in there, but kind of half speed so that he could make contact, and it could never work. Randy Johnson couldn't throw it at half speed.
Right.
So they had
to speed for him is 85 miles an hour.
Yeah. He couldn't even do that. That was,
I heard he was a pretty good ball player, Busfield.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, I heard he was pretty good.
Yeah. One of the tricks about baseball movies, a lot of times is that the baseball doesn't always look real. I think in this movie, it came out pretty well. The baseball looked real, at least.
It did. It's tricky because you can't assume that these guys are athletes. I mean, if you're lucky, you know, like Redford did a pretty good imitation of a ball player in The Natural. He looked pretty good. And Costner is a good athlete, and he's done it a bunch of times.
Yeah.
But it's very tricky. It's very tricky. I have a scene in Yankee Stadium that I shot with Nick Cage, who I realized couldn't really throw a ball. So we made him a catcher, and he sort of tossed it back. You have to work with what you can do.
That's and it could happen to you. You got to film at the original Yankee Stadium for that, huh?
And met Bob Shepard, which was one of the great thrills of my entire lifetime. What a sweet guy he was.
Isn't it amazing when you meet him and that voice comes out of the person?
You cannot believe it. And you say, please, can I get my answering machine here right now so you could record my message, you know?
Did you get him to do one for you?
No. I didn't have the equipment with me. I should have thought of it, but he was so sweet. That was great being able to use the bullpen.
Yeah, it's, you talk about, you know, being starstruck in different things, about meeting people, but, in a venue that you've been in before as a fan, getting to work in it must have been something special.
No, to be on that field and to stand on third base and realize you have to throw the ball from here to first base, and these guys do it, they make it look like nothing when you stand there. It's like you got to throw a javelin across the football field. It's just, there's a reason they pay these guys this money. It really is not easy.
Yeah. And being even without seeing the actual people do it up close, just being on the field.
Oh, seeing the dimensions. That was the thing that killed me. That third to first is that, oh my God, how do you do this?
Yeah. And people think, 314 down the right field line, that's easy, right? But it's.
Try it, do it.
Yeah. It's easy for them. It's not easy for everybody else. What are your favorite baseball movies?
Favorite baseball movies? Well, of course, I blubbered through Field of Dreams. When he starts having a catch with his old man, that's just, that's unbearable, heartbreaking. Pride of the Yankees is really a pretty good movie. And the fact that the babe is actually in it doing dialogue is a treat. What are your favorite? I'm trying to think. The Natural was a hell of a movie.
Natural's
not really a baseball movie, but it's a hell of a movie.
Listen, Bull Durham, Field of Dreams, and Major
Bull
League.
Bull Durham is very. Bull Durham is probably the most baseball-y. Costner really gets it about baseball. Mm-hmm. I do believe that. Eight Men Out was pretty good.
Eight Men Out's a terrific movie. Major League is a movie that I think a lot of baseball players gravitate to. Just, it's silly, but it also feels real as far as just the baseball action a lot of times.
Yeah, I can believe it. Doing sports movies is so hard. To make it look real, to make it look like it's really, really happening, it's very difficult.
Yeah, it's kind of, and people keep going back to it. So there must be something. Do they go back to it because it works, or do they go back to it because they keep thinking they can make it perfect?
Well, I think for a lot of people, particularly men, it's so in their DNA. It's so much part of their life. It's so much a part of their growing up. It certainly was for me, that at some point you want to go there. You just want to be there. Sort of a semi-religious thing. It's like there have always been tons of boxing movies. I mean, the best being, of course, Raging Bull. And that you just got such a feeling for the atmosphere and for the brutality and the beauty of it. That's an amazing picture, amazing movie.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned boxing, because now I'm thinking about the original one, but one of my favorite movies that's a wonderful movie, and it's got sports in it. It's not a sports movie. Heaven Can Wait has a lot of good sports action, and it's based off the original, which is a boxing film originally, but it's got a lot of terrific sports action. It's not a sports movie. It's a phenomenal movie. It works on all those levels.
Yeah, it's a wonderful movie.
And they make the action look pretty good. Warren Beatty pulls that off pretty good.
Well, I think he played football in high school.
Oh, yeah. Beatty. All right, so I want to ask you about a couple of movies that you worked on.
Okay.
You wrote a movie that I kind of believe is probably one of the most three or four most often quoted movies of my generation. You wrote Fletch. When Fletch comes out in the mid 80s, it did very well. It was a $50 million box office movie, but it also took part in the VHS revolution and then the cable replays. So it's on all the time. People see it a lot over the course of time. And because of the little one-liners that get dropped in throughout the whole movie, I feel like it's become one of the most, at least in my generation, my circle of people, one of the most often quoted movies. How do you feel about that movie?
I feel good about that movie. It was from a book called Fletch, a good book by Gregory MacDonald. I wrote the original script in like 4 weeks, and I can't write a check in 4 weeks. I mean, it takes me forever to do anything. We had a very hot actor at that time. You know, Chevy was big news. Universal treated the movie like it was going to be a hit from day one. And it was a really, really very, very pleasant experience. Michael Ritchie was the director, a guy I liked a lot. And it just became, you never know why these things become phenomena. But there was a kind of wise ass thing that it tapped into among adolescent boys. I heard somebody tell me he went to Princeton. They said there was a particular eating club at Princeton where you couldn't get in unless you had memorized the whole script. You'd be quizzed on it, on Fletch, to get into Princeton of all places. So yeah, it was a really cool experience.
I'm curious about process. When you're writing that, how much of that is just your words? How much of that is Chevy Chase's words and thoughts? How much of it is a combination?
I don't think it's just thoughts. He certainly did some great ad-libbing in it, you know. Cujo, there are various things that happened that he was very quick. He's a bright guy. At one point, he claimed he actually wrote the script, which wasn't true because he wrote that one. Yeah. What about Fletch Lives? Didn't he write that one too? you got to take credit for all of them. but yeah, and it really helps so much when you know who you're writing for specifically. That is a blessing. I mean, I had that with The In-Laws because I knew I was writing it for Peter Falk and Alan Arkin. I had that when I rewrote The Freshman because I knew Brando was going to be in it, so I'm writing for him. So it focuses you enormously. And Chevy had a particular, as I say, this kind of wise-ass frat boy thing, and made my work a lot easier.
Do you like when people quote movies to you or your movies to you? Is that a compliment to a writer?
If they come up to me in the street, they would say, don't. The good, the blessing about being a writer is nobody knows who you are. So it's not like people are going to run up to me on the subway and say, hey, you wrote Fletch. But yeah, certainly like Serpentine from The In-Laws is like a big deal, you know. But yeah, of course it's a compliment because, you know, you're doing it so you can live forever. You know, every writer wants to cheat death and be in there forever. So yeah, if you write stuff that gets in there in people's DNA, sure, absolutely.
Do you recognize it all right away? Because I remember hearing an interview with Tim Robbins where, you know, he says he's a sports fan. He meets baseball players and they come up and they drop lines from Bull Durham to him, and he has not a clue what they're talking about because he made the movie and never watched it again. Do you recognize your own, you know, when someone just drops a, you know, I mean, the put it on the Underhills tab is kind of an easy one, but if someone drops
things, that is an easy one. Well, the thing is, if he's the actor, he read the lines.
Yeah.
Once you write them and then you've rewritten them 50 times, plus if you directed, you've seen every inch of the movie 5,000 times. So you literally, once it opens, you never see it again. You can't look at it. Yeah. It's like eating the same meal, you know, for 6 weeks. You just can't do it. I say, not spaghetti again. So you don't. But in terms of if people come up to me and say Serpentine, I certainly don't wonder what they're talking about.
Yeah. Do you ever watch, you know, you mentioned the process of making it and then watching it over and over again after it's out. I mean, when was the last time you watched Blazing Saddles or you watched Fletch or It Could Happen to You?
From beginning to end, I can't remember. I'm sure almost never. I now have grandchildren, so they're beginning to be able to watch certain sections of Blazing Saddles. You know, my 8-year-old has been now seen just the campfire scene because there's no language in it, but he's certainly that he comprehends. Anybody comprehends that.
Yeah.
It's so basic. But yeah, you can't watch them. It's just you know, you just get up and walk out of the room. It's too inside you at this point. It's like you don't want to relive that. But there's certainly parts I watch with great pleasure. I say, oh, I remember that. But what you do, particularly if you directed the movie, you will think, not what you're seeing so much, you'll say, God, it was freezing that day. I remember I remember it took us 20 minutes to get the guy to say that, you know, that's what you remember.
There are, you know, there are remote control stoppers on TV, right? But I know like a lot of movies are just comfort food. And I know that if I'm kind of maybe doing something in my office and I flip around to see something is on, and if it's Fletch or It Could Happen to You, whatever, or Little Big League, you know, it goes on the TV and I go about what I'm doing and I'm watching it. Will you stumble upon one of your movies and watch it, or will you avoid it because it's one of your movies?
I'll watch it for as long as I can tolerate it, which is probably
selling a little or a lot. Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify is got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odyssey podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odyssey podcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/odyssey podcast.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
4 or 5 minutes.
That's it, huh?
You probably, yeah. Not of any dislike, just out of that, you had so much of it, you know?
Yeah.
Filled you every waking minute of your life, particularly when you direct them. You wake up thinking about it, you fall asleep thinking about it, you know?
I want to ask you about the process of Blazing Saddles.
Okay.
You're credited with the story and among the writers, the group of writers. It's you, it's Norman Steinberg, Alan Ugar, and of course, Mel Brooks and Richard Pryor.
Right.
That's a lot of people writing one movie. What's the process like? Do you write scenes together? Do you write them apart and come sit together? And
well, that was very unique, that movie. I had sold the story and written the first draft of a script called Tex-X. Tex is just the letter X, like as in Malcolm, mm-hmm. About a black sheriff in the Old West. I sold it to Warner Brothers. It was like the only high concept idea I ever had in my life. But they made it, and originally Alan Arkin was going to direct it, and James Earl Jones was going to be the sheriff, and that didn't work out. So then they came to me and said, how about Mel Brooks? I love Mel Brooks. You know, I was the 2,000-year-old man. It's one of the funniest things that ever created by anybody. So let's give it a shot. And Mel had decided he wanted to do this like they did the old show of shows, the Caesar show. He wanted to do it in a room with people and to everybody be bouncing ideas of everybody. So he got a guy named Norman Steinberg, who had a writing partner named Alan Uger. And Alan dropped out pretty early. And then we said, we have to have a black writer. We can't have four Jews writing something about a black sheriff. We were, you know, it's not even that we were woke, it's just, it won't be any good, you know? And Richie came and he sort of liberated all of us, you know, because he just went for it. And then we all went for it. And then for 6 weeks, we all wrote together. And then Richie went off to be Richie, and Mel and Norman and I wrote the bulk of it after that. But it was very collegial. It was not one, everybody wrote together. Everybody in a room screaming and a lot of stuff. Some things I can remember, oh, that was my idea, but mostly it was collaborative, really collaborative, in that you don't know who said what after a while.
Yeah.
Which is the best, you know?
I guess as the movie grows through time, it's mostly considered Mel Brooks and Richard Pryor, but I mean, everybody contributed a lot of equal amounts is what you're saying in that collaborative process.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Anybody who's in that room would say that. I mean, you know, Richie was the name brand and so was Mel, but over the years that's changed, you know?
What stands out to you about how that movie has kind of stayed through the course of time? Because if you sent that script to somebody today, you couldn't get it made for a lot of reasons. But, you know, what do you think about, you know, it's almost 50 years now that movie's been made.
Amazingly, yes. Could it get made today? Of course not. I mean, for any number of reasons.
Right.
The cost would be prohibitive. Forget the language. Forget, you know, now more than ever, you couldn't get it made. Even 10 years ago, you could say, it'd be tough to get it made, but maybe you could get it made. Now, you know, it's not even fathomable to get it made for a lot of reasons. Many of them, I think, unfortunate. And the studio thought it was going to be a disaster. I mean, once they saw it, they thought it was going to go immediately into the dumper. And they were as surprised as anybody when it just opened and it's just opened and it kept going and going and going and going. The word of mouth in the movie was stupendous. And it's such a dense movie. The thing is, you really had to see it three times to get half the jokes.
Yeah, yeah.
There's so much going on, you know, which was the advantage of having multiple writers because we were all, you know, feeding this machine. It was a great experience. It really was.
It feels so smart too, the more that you watch it, and I just, you know, like you said, you have to understand the layers and the jokes to watch it multiple times, but you know, it's not slapstick. It's not silly. I mean, it is all that, but
it's all of that,
but it's so smart.
It's very smart. That's why you have to see it a lot because there's so many things going on. And what to me is the cleverest thing is, you know, in my original, there was an interracial romance, which at that point, this 1973, could be shocking. I thought it was going to be this black sheriff and somebody like, you know, Candace Bergen, who was the daughter of the railroad magnate, mm-hmm. and have a real hot and heavy romance. I thought the genius of what Mel did with Madeleine Kahn, this Marlene Dietrich's semi-Nazi singer,
yeah.
He didn't even realize it was an interracial romance anymore. It was so funny that you'd never even thought, oh my God, this is, and it's 1974. It wasn't like the common currency at the time.
Yeah.
But you made the interracial romance work. You figured she was absolutely nuts about him. He was sort of crazy about her. You did it in very bold satiric terms, but we completely got away with it. No one ever said, ah, you can't do that. The movie wasn't like banned in Mississippi because it was an interracial romance. It's like once you made her a Nazi, she wasn't a white person anymore. It was a brilliant move. I don't think it did it consciously, but it worked out that way.
Like anything else, you tried to, you know, if it works, somebody wants more of it. You had a TV series kind of based off of it, right? Never really took off.
Yeah, that was short lived, as those things generally are. Yeah. You know, you can't get lightning in a bottle again, you know. It actually wasn't bad. Lou Gossett Jr. played the sheriff, and Lou Gossett Jr. is terrific, but it's just it wasn't meant to be.
You know, and when we talk about how
Like, the movie is silly and crazy, but it's also so smart. There's another movie, a more recent vintage, that I kind of think is like that. And I don't know if you've seen it, if you think about it. Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle is billed as a...
I never saw that. I like those guys, but I never saw that movie.
It's a really smart comedy because it's billed as this stoner movie, but right. It's laced with all of this racial, ethnic stereotype type of right. things. And it's a smart commentary on all of that. And I think it feels to me like in the vein of Blazing Saddles, where wrapped up in all the silly humor is something that when you watch it a couple more times, you really get how smart it is. Mm-hmm.
I have to catch up to it at some point. I never did, but I like those guys.
You have spent a lot of years watching Yankee baseball. Will you remember your first time going to Yankee Stadium?
Unforgettable. It was 1953. And the weird thing is I dug up a broadcast of the game at some point.
Wow.
On a Chicago White Sox website, because it was an extraordinary thing happening in the game. The Yankees were playing the White Sox at Yankee Stadium. The Whites, it was tied or something, or the Yankees were losing going into the ninth, or they had a slight lead. Anyhow, the White Sox had a left-handed pitcher named Tommy Byrne, who later on pitched for the Yankees, B-Y-R-N-E. Red Barber always called that good hitting pitcher. He was a very good hitter. And they brought him up to pinch hit. He was a pitcher, but they brought him in to pinch hit with the bases loaded. Hits a grand slam home run. That's my first game. Wow. He hits a grand slam to beat the Yankees into the porch. And they lose, I don't know, 5-2 or whatever it was. But that was it. That was the first one. I said, wow, this is weird. And there's Jack Brickhouse, somebody calling the game, yeah. From wow. Chicago. It was crazy. But the first time you walk into Yankee Stadium as a kid, it's just awe-inspiring. And that was the old stadium, you know, the 60,000 seats, all of which were behind a post. I mean, the thing about the old stadium had all these girders. So wherever you were sitting, you were always like going from side to side to get all of the field in front of you. But it was really, it was like a temple. It was just an astounding place. And you could walk out on the field after the game. That was the wonderful thing. You could leave. People walked left by the bullpens. You walked out through the bullpens out into the Bronx.
I'm assuming that like everybody else at that age, you're a Mickey Mantle fan.
I was always a perverse person. I was a Hank Bauer fan.
Oh, no kidding.
God knows why. I just thought he was great. It's my perverse streak. I mean, he was amazing, Mickey. He certainly was. You forget his speed. I still remember his, as much as his home runs, I remember his, seeing him drag bunt, seeing him go down to first base, you know, like a nanosecond. It was a guy that with that size and that power to be that quick was amazing. He wasn't really a great outfielder, but he was so fast, he just caught up to everything, you know.
You know, it's funny hearing you describe it that way. It makes me think of something that we mentioned Roger Angel earlier, who wrote this article that The Scout is based off of.
Yeah.
Roger mentioned something in his speech a couple of years ago in Cooperstown, where he talked about seeing something in the mind's eye. You know, nowadays, someone makes a great play, you see the replay a billion times 10 right. minutes later on all forms of media, and you know, and it's there. But there's yeah. something about seeing something in your mind's eye. You talk about, you know, watching Mickey Mantle run home to first or making a play in the outfield. Those are things, maybe you don't have the specific, but there is still a very vivid memory etched in your mind, isn't there?
Very. I'll tell you another one. I mean, DiMaggio had retired by the time I was, you know, he retired, I think he was 37 when he retired. And now he would have been a DH. He would have gotten $80 million a year until he was 60. But then he retired. So he had a bum leg in the money. He couldn't be Joe DiMaggio anymore. But I did see him play at an old-timers game. An old-timer, meaning then he was like 40. He was still a young man. And he was playing center field, and somebody had a short center. And he came in, and I'll never forget how he caught the ball. He came in. It was like he was on wheels. He wasn't running. He was just, he just suddenly appeared and there he was to catch the ball. It was wow. really, it was so graceful without trying to be graceful. It's just, that's the way he ran. But it really was like he had wheels.
All right. So I want to ask you if there's a sports kind of movie that you've ever wanted to make and for whatever various reasons, a dream project? Is it something related to your Yankee fandom or a boyhood hero or just a story that you found fascinating that you've wanted to make and for whatever reason just hasn't gotten done?
It's tricky with sports movies. You know, William Goldman had a great line about golf. Why he never wrote a golf movie. He said, whatever you do, it's going to come down to a putt on the 18th. And that's it. That's the end of any. See, you're limited. That's where you're going to wind up. That's the last scene. Right. I wrote sort of a boxing chain gang movie once, which I never sold, very early on, called Kid Gloves, about a guy who escapes from a chain gang and becomes a great boxer, which was sort of a spoof on all the chain gang movies. But no, I don't have any more sports movies in me.
I had, I spoke a couple of years, maybe it was last year, I spoke with Angelo Pizzo, who wrote Hoosiers, and he wrote Rudy, two of the best sports movies ever, right? He told me that he has a Mickey Mantle biopic screenplay that he thinks is better than anything he's ever written. Now, I'm thinking he's written Rudy, he's written Hoosiers, and he thinks this is better than both of those. You've made some phenomenal movies. You've directed some, you've produced some, you've written some. We've talked about some of them here already. Is there anything that's kind of in your holster that you think is better or that is a terrific movie that for whatever reason hasn't gotten made?
Oh, sure. I have, after Blazing Saddles, I wrote a movie called Rhapsody in Crime, which was like all the old gangster movies in one. And Warner Brothers bought it. And for various reasons, there was no real producer involved. It never got made. They decided, well, why don't you write the script for Peter fucking Alan Arkin instead? But Rhapsody in Crime was a great movie. There's a script called Ottoman Empire about a porn actor who gets involved with the First Lady of the United States. It was a great script. And it had Keanu Reeves. I was going to do it, and that fell apart. Because I had just done a movie that bombed terribly, and that was it. Suddenly, no one wanted to trust me with $10 million to do a $20 million. So that one, those are my two heartbreaks, Rhapsody and Ottoman Empire. I love this. Actually, sports, I did do a basketball television series once, which we never got off the ground. But I wrote it with Norman Steinberg, who's one of the writers of Blazing Saddles. It was called Shoot, and it was sort of based on the old Knicks. This is, you had a Clyde character, you had a Bradley guy, a very bookish guy. And yet a guy who was always injured, who was sort of based on Willis in those days, who was hurt all the time. And we had a great name for him. His name was Street Clothes Smith, because he was always in street clothes. And every game, he was dressed in these fabulous outfits. He had these casts with like rhinestones on them. He had this fabulous orthopedic stuff he wore, but he never played because he was always hurt. But that was street clothes.
That might be more entertaining than the real Knicks these days.
Well, the real Knicks are not unentertaining anymore. They finally look to actually be. I mean, that's been a heartbreak. I mean, I grew up with that team, you know, that fabulous team, and I've watched my two sons suffer brutally for their entire lives with this team, and the dumbest owner who ever lived. But this team looks like a team, you know, and they have a real coach. They're not going to win it this year, but they're not uninteresting. At least you can turn on and feel like proud to be rooting for them. You know, they have some fight in them, and they have some good young players. They really do.
Listen, you're a sports fan, and you're a writer who writes, you know, scripts. So, do you ever feel like, do you wish you could just script out the ending when you're watching a sports event, when you're watching a Yankee game or a Knicks game? Do you just wish you could make it end the way you want it to end?
I certainly have always rooted for some horrible thing to happen to the Red Sox just as they're running onto the field. But any other team, you know, I mean, they play I hated the Dodgers since birth. If Dodgers play the Red Sox in the World Series, I'll be rooting for the Dodgers. I mean, the Red Sox are just so, to hate them is so in my DNA. It's completely irrational, but that's the basis of sports. But the Dodgers do have a terrifying lineup. They really do.
That's why sports is so much fun to watch, right? You can't
it's
script it.
Endless, because it's real, you know?
Yeah.
It's just real. And that's the beauty of it. That's the power of it. It's happening in front of you. And they can't cook the books. They just, you know, they got to go out there and do it, you know? No matter what they pay these guys, they still got to do it and hit a ball.
My thanks to Andy Bergman. His film credits are among my personal favorites. I have a group of friends who routinely quote Honeymoon in Vegas. We all know someone who quotes Fletch, probably, right? And Blazing Saddles is among the top three or four comedies ever by any standard you want to use. Hey, if you're new here, please check out the 30 with Murdy archive at Odyssey or Apple Podcasts. If you enjoyed this, go back and listen to my conversations with Phil Alden Robinson, the writer and director of Field of Dreams, or one with Angelo Pizzo, the writer of Hoosiers and Rudy, or my chat with Mark Chardy, the former big league pitcher who went on to produce Miracle, The Rookie, and many others, including the upcoming American Underdog, the story of Super Bowl champ Kurt Warner. Dennis Quaid plays Dick Vermeil in that film, and I recently spoke to Quaid on this podcast as well. Plenty of baseball conversations in the queue also, so go back and enjoy. Tis the season for holiday travel, so hopefully this helps you pass some time. Make sure to subscribe and review and all that jazz. And until next time, I'm Sweeney Murdy. Thanks for listening.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.